Welcome to The Gauge, a new podcast brought to you by Green Gauge, the first fully integrated financial services group, bridging the traditional financial services space with the new digital innovations in crypto assets and blockchain. In this series, we gauge expert opinion on the latest tech trends and plan to bring you a measured approach to discussing key developments in the world of blockchain and digital assets. Your host today is Green Gauge's CEO, Sean Kiernan, who is in conversation with Rosalind Breedy. Rosalind is a corporate funds and financial services lawyer with 30 years' experience of working in private practice, investment banking, and at a multifamily office. She has a particular interest in financial regulation and financial policy work alongside ESG, diversity, and inclusion. She is also a Green Gauge board member. Today, Sean and Rosalind will be discussing creating an entrepreneurial culture in the UK, the need for greater diversity and inclusion, and her favourite things about working with entrepreneurs.
Rosalind, I'm so excited to have you here today. Obviously, a pleasure that you've joined us on the board of directors at Green Gauge. You've had a long and successful career in law and wealth management, and one of your areas of specialism is working with entrepreneurs. Green Gauge recently published a paper looking at the fundamental role of SMEs in the UK economy. Do you think we could do a bit more to support entrepreneurialism in this country?
Thanks for inviting me this afternoon, Sean. I'm really looking forward to the podcast. Yeah, I think entrepreneurialism in the UK is an absolutely fascinating topic. And the short answer to your question is yes, we could do more. Everyone can do more. However, I really want to talk about some of the advantages that the UK has with regards to supporting entrepreneurialism and maybe some of the challenges it needs to work upon. So with regard to the advantages, we're really lucky to have a robust system of law that protects intellectual property rights. I think that's sort of critical to developing innovation. We have quite an adaptable legal system, so we're able to contract and have our contracts enforced with courts who are independent. What else can I say? We have an educated workforce, and we have great universities who are kind of hotbeds for innovation. With regards to our culture, there's been a lot of research done by academics, from the Netherlands and in London, showing that we are a very entrepreneurial culture. We're great at risk-taking and getting things off the ground, not so good at seeing them through to fruition. And we have problems and barriers with regards to access to finance and labour mobility. London sucks in a lot of the entrepreneurial talent, and we really need to make sure that people can launch and grow entrepreneurial ventures elsewhere in the country, is my view.
That's a really interesting take, and I think people have spoken about the UK as a nation of shopkeepers, but entrepreneurial culture. The other end of the spectrum is what might be deemed the UK Mittelstand.
Oh, yes.
Or companies that work in, say, the industrial space.
Yes.
Very similar to what happens in Germany with the SMEs.
Yes.
And family-owned businesses. Do you think such a segment really exists in the UK? And if so, would that be a segment that maybe policy should look to support?
Yeah, does it exist? I think it does. It's different to how it manifests itself in Germany for a number of reasons. I would say that our equivalent of the Mittelstand would be our UK family business. And I'm a great fan of UK family businesses. They do so much for this country. They employ, I think, like 80% of employees. There's some huge figure. I've probably got that wrong. But it's in that order of magnitude. They provide stability and cohesion in their regions. They decentralise because they're all around the country. And family businesses provide employment. They train people. They have a much longer term approach to development of people. I think they're really good things on so many levels. I think they face a set of unique challenges. So I guess I'd put the first set of those challenges in the bucket of innovation. It's quite hard when, you're a family, to kind of necessarily take on advice from outsiders. It's quite hard to reinvent yourself. And I think a number of UK family businesses, when the founder is coming to retirement, often find themselves being sold, and that's a shame. I think what they need help with is, how do they improve their business processes, their product development? And again, I think coming back to universities, I'm doing a lot of work with the University of Bristol at the moment in this respect with innovation. Universities have all the research, they have the capabilities, so it would be good to try and get those networks working. I think the other thing that I think is really fantastic about UK family businesses is they really help with that, with basically the concept of trust, which I think is essential for the development of a robust entrepreneurial culture. Because when, you know, when push comes to shove, you're asking someone to trust you with their money. That's basically it. And that you're going to do good things with it and, you know, create a venture that's going to make more money. And if you don't know people, you can't trust them. So although, you know, we have a very good entrepreneurial culture, I'll come back to that initial point, we still do have lots of barriers with regard to access to finance. And I think one of those barriers is sort of lack of trust. And I think coming back to your point about family businesses, where family businesses can help in that respect, is that they could seed ventures because, you know, they've got a proven track record, they know how to run a business, they're not going anywhere anytime soon, you know, they can train people. You know, they, in some ways, we could take all our lovely family businesses and team them up with universities for innovation. And so I'm sure we're going to talk about the sort of financial world and the investment world. And that would be a fabulous architecture for this country.
It's a fascinating way of framing it. And I think it sounds as if a lot of the pieces of the puzzle are there. I mean, we have world-class universities. We have lots of families running, as you say, quite a few very internationally successful businesses that employ a lot of, in the country. What do you think practically could be done to bring them together? Is this a ground roots objective? Is it maybe working with a few families? Or is it something maybe at a policy level with...
But it's such a good question because I've been thinking about this, and I think one of the ways sometimes I think the UK can go wrong, you know, it's a plus and a minus, is that we're very good, we're a very pragmatic nation. We get stuff done, and we solve the problem, and we, you know, and we take pride in that, and so we should. I think where we could learn perhaps from the Germans and other nations is to be a little bit more strategic and long term in approach. And think about, you know, what are the core processes that we need to put in place for this to work. And it's interesting that having looked at some of the research that's been done by sort of European academics, we rank quite low on business process innovation. And I think, you know, and that has, you know, caused us a number of problems. And of course, that's something the universities are very good at. So to answer your question, how do we solve it? Is it a strategic framework, top down, or is it bottom up? It's actually, as with all things, it's both. But I think the strategic framework needs an engineer, you know, to actually put it together, because actually that's what engineers do. They make things work. We've got great engineers. We should ask them to do more stuff for us. And for me, from what I can see, from the work that I've been doing, is that we need to tie in the policy, and you can see great policy coming from places like Innovate UK. And in fact, a lot of this is happening already. They've got their catapult strategy. I think I've talked to you a little bit about the 9 catapults that we have in this country, which are all centres of excellence for different competencies. Yep. So for example, in Bristol, it's the high value manufacturing. I mean, in Manchester, it's retail. And that's a fantastic idea because you get a cluster approach where you really seed and support innovation. And you get research grants, and you get people who have those skills go and work there. And one of the other key points of Catapult is that they've been set up to deal with this issue that we've always had in the UK, where we have lots of entrepreneurial activity and spin-outs, and, you know, great businesses being started and lots of very big businesses being very successful. But, you know, we call it Death Valley, you know, that taking the smaller companies to the successful pathway, we've not been consistently good at doing that. And then again, that comes back to access to finance, because if you're not very good at doing that, how can, you know, thinking of finance as a pipeline, you know, that's kind of like the spray and pray approach, isn't it? You know, you've got to have, you know, a more successful way of ensuring that businesses that who have been backed at the early stage are going to be successful in the later stage. Again, coming back to family businesses, you know, they sit in that middle. So I think they've got an important part to play. And I think they've got a lot of knowledge to share. They probably don't know it explicitly because they just get on and do it. But I think they've got deep pools of knowledge.
It's really intriguing to hear. I mean, family businesses are by nature kind of driven by people, the members of the family. And often the family members themselves are quite low profile.
Yes.
There are exceptional cases.
Yeah.
The Richard Bransons of the world, maybe they want the limelight. But to think of involving families directly in policy shaping it is a really interesting consideration for me. And I think that the mythical word of levelling up seems to
get
a little bit of structure
in
the way you've described.
Yeah, also we were having a little conversation, obviously, before we started the podcast, and you know, I was having a great chat with a taxi driver, and because we also think of big businesses, and actually, you know, most people run small businesses, and entrepreneur, you know, you could be a hairdresser, you could be a cab driver, you know, and all these people need help with their businesses and access to finance and planning for the future. And particularly when you're a small business owner, you know, the future of your business is tied to the success of yourself as a person, with your health, you know, the support that you have in your family, and do you have the skill? You know, it's really tough. So, and I think that's where family businesses can help and give some insight, because they know how long it takes to do things. You know, they know how to employ people and reward and incentivize them. A small business owner has to learn all of those things, you know, on the fly. And I just think we have to stop doing things on the fly and people learning by trial and error. There's a very much, it's tied in with that pragmatic approach to life. We do kind of, you know, we do like trial and error.
Yes.
And, which is nothing wrong with that, because that's important for innovation. But I think you've got to step a level above that and realise that sometimes we know what works, what doesn't work. So let's just share the information. The other thing I think that's really important is education. We really do think the entrepreneurial agenda needs to be brought into schools and into universities much more. And that is all happening. I know the Royal Society of Arts is doing a lot of work in this space, as well as the universities. Because I think everybody, whether you're a school child or a graduate, you know, being an entrepreneur or working for an entrepreneur is probably something you're going to face. And yet nobody really knows what it means. And you have to sort of think about, you know, the kind of business you're joining. If it's very small, are you really going to be staying there for the rest of your life? You know, these are kind of loads of questions which everybody kind of finds out when they hit that point. And I think that with more of a policy perspective, again, we can help avoid some of those issues. I don't know if that made sense.
Perfectly. It's something that you're obviously passionate about. I think you enjoy working with entrepreneurs. What are some of your favourite things about kind of an entrepreneurial client, partner, and what you do?
Oh, I think the most exciting thing about entrepreneurs is they're all different. And they've all, there's a reason for their venture. And the only way I can find it, explain it to somebody who has not been, you know, in that experience, it's a bit like being asked to go on a journey with someone that you really don't know. You're going to climb a mountain and we're going to face some challenges, and you're going to get through this, you know, with your resources and your network. And each journey is different. But what you do as part of that journey is you build a really close bond, because you're as an advisor, you are trusted. And I know that many lawyers and accountants feel the same. You know, we have our professional objectivity because we need to do that to give advice. But we really care about our clients because you're giving up a lot of your life energy, you know, to help them for a lot of their life. So it's a very special relationship. I always think that for entrepreneurs, their relationship with their venture is very much, you know, it's their baby. I'm thinking it's probably overused this term, but it is their baby. It's something that they've taken from conception and who growing, being nurtured, or face challenges, has to be looked after and loved, and it has to be introduced to lots of people who are going to help it on its journey, and you're going to be able to present it. So, you know, if that's the analogy for the entrepreneur, I think the analogy for the advisor, who, you know, typically is the lawyer or the accountant, sometimes the bank manager, depending, then you are the godparent. So you keep a weather eye on how it's all going, and, you know, make interventions as tactfully and politely as you can, and you turn up at the 21st birthday party.
Which is always a fun one to go to.
Absolutely.
Yes, we spoke a bit about education and also the fundamental strengths of the UK.
Yeah.
And about kind of how entrepreneurs come from all stripes.
Yes.
If there's a problem that is identified, someone has almost a bee in their bonnet, they get a passion themselves to sort something out.
Yes.
These entrepreneurs come in all shapes and sizes.
Yes.
And I was curious what you think, as a country, we could do to maybe give a voice
to
entrepreneurs that come from different backgrounds.
Well, I think it's so close to my heart. I think there's many ways of looking at it. So first of all is, you know, do you see yourself as an entrepreneur? So if you've not come from an entrepreneurial background, or you've not had much exposure to that, you know, where do you get that kind of knowledge and insight? Well, it's kind of like Dragon's Den and The Apprentice and programs like that, which are all helpful because at least it gets people talking about it. But it's sometimes not realistic as to, you know, what the journey is. And also, I think people need to understand, you know, what traits you need to have. And I think the most important trait is resilience and persistence and the ability to see things through and to be trustworthy. Pretty much everything else we can teach, but those are the key personal traits. I think then having exposure to other entrepreneurs, people who've built businesses, own business at different stages, and having a network, that's really hard for people who've not come from those kind of backgrounds. So I think that's something we can do as a country and as a business community, and we'll come back onto what some of those ideas might be. And then just teaching some lessons. We're really lucky we have the internet. We can do, me and my YouTubes, we can do YouTubes with people who are experts just talking about how to solve a problem. And I think that when you're an entrepreneur who has really not the access to the kinds of people who can help you, using the internet and learning from the internet is really important. But then you need accredited people who know what they're talking about and haven't got an agenda to spin. I think then also the government and the universities and the finance houses can feed in so we can get the knowledge and education. I'm really convinced we can do that. I also think things like financial skills, sometimes the financial skills for people who want to start on the just are not strong enough. Now, Martin Lewis, he's a great person. I know he's written a book for schools to teach those skills. Why don't we just teach it? I think everybody needs to have these basic skills. Even if they're not going to be an entrepreneur, they're going to be working for a business owner, they're still going to have to deal with finances. So I think those are the important components. And then I think the final bit is network. It's really hard when you don't know people to kind of just go and introduce yourself and get involved. So we need to make it easier for people to be included. And that means entrepreneurs of different backgrounds, different cultures, different ethnicities, they need to come to the forefront and be really visible so that people can see people who look like them and they can hear stories that they can relate to. And then they can extrapolate from that how their own personal journey might be.
It's really interesting to hear that. I think you and I both agree that there's a lot of untapped talent.
Yes.
And how do we give shape to that talent? Because I think there's a lot of diamonds in the rough, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ideas and people. And I hear again and again that education is a big step.
Yes.
Getting basics for how to balance a book or how to
how
to look at a P&L. Practically, I think Martin Lewis's book and suggestions are very helpful.
Yeah.
Education in schools and universities and is great. Do you think there's anything as a business community that we can do?
Yes. Absolutely. We can all do more. And I think, for example, we could get together people who are experts in different fields of business and to say, these are the common questions we get asked. As a lawyer, I could say I get asked these three questions all the time. Why don't we record it? So that's just a sort of off the top answer. Again, coming back to my business process fascination, we are people who run businesses. If this was a business problem, how would we solve it? And it's about, understanding who the stakeholders are, what their needs are, what is the product that they need to service that? How would we keep that going? How would it be funded? All those questions. And then I think probably the piece that the business community and I think also the universities really need to work on is communication, because they speak at a very high level. They're kind of talking to themselves very often. And actually what you're trying to do in this is talk to people who are not like you. So you have to, I really believe in being very visual. So getting people to talk a bit like this and ask questions rather than, give someone like a, big tome to read. And another thing to understand about entrepreneurs, many entrepreneurs are dyslexic. Mm. They are people who are neurodiverse. Many of them are neurodiverse and they take information in differently. But then we've got the research. We know that. So why do we just keep giving them white papers to read?
Yes, I'm partially to blame for that. I was really fascinated. There was a group of us that were invited to speak in Parliament a few weeks ago about blockchain and technology that's unfolding. And one of the questions was asked by a member of the Lords afterwards, why are you using so many acronyms? Why is this so unintelligible to someone who admittedly is highly educated and sitting in the House of Lords? Yeah. One can only think that, particularly for someone coming from a non-financial services background, that we're speaking gobbledygook.
We are. I mean, let's be honest. I think the thing is, and then to be fair to us as a financial community and any community, you develop your shorthands because otherwise life would just take too long to have a conversation. And that's great because that means that improves the communication with the people in that community. But if your goal is to communicate with people who are by definition not in that community, you have to be very structured in how you think about how you're going to communicate. And one thing might be not to use acronyms, not to assume, to explain core concepts, because, you know, very often in a field like finance, you know, there's certain core concepts you've just got to understand. And so if the person you're trying to communicate with doesn't understand that, you know, where can I go and find out? So you can signpost and say, okay, you know, go and find out about compound interest. You know, here's a good site or whatever it is. So I think that's really important. I also think you need to have people of different backgrounds, different ages, different cultures, different ethnicities to have those conversations for two reasons. Firstly, because you've got people with different backgrounds, they're going to understand what the audience might need. You're going to get to a better result. And then secondly, the audience are more likely to listen if they can see that there are lots of different people saying this and people who they can relate to. If you have a group of people who don't look like them, don't sound like them, speaking gobbledygook, you know, you're not going to get much trust either. Because again, I come back to that key concept of trust.
Yeah.
In order to move forward and to make change, people have to trust each other.
And use different formats. I think you've often been telling me we shouldn't just write white papers, we should do various things, also in person perhaps, including podcasts.
Yeah.
I do have to ask about crypto.
Oh, okay.
A bit,
yeah.
As we are here at The Gauge. And what are your interests really in the crypto sector? And do you think, as we're kind of a subset of fintech, what can we do as a space to contribute to the entrepreneurial economy in the UK?
I have to say, my interest in this sector was inspired by you, Sean. I don't think I would have ever had an interest in this sector if I hadn't met you. And I think, you know, my reservations would have been that I wouldn't have trusted it. I didn't understand it. All those things, the gobbledygook, it seemed quite male to me. I don't know. Yeah. And also, you know, there's a big strand of sort of libertarianism, which is not me, because I'm a very, you know, that's just politically, that's just not where I am at. And also, I feel it was in danger of becoming a bit of a closed community. And, you know, lots of reasons why I didn't particularly want to engage with it, actually. But, you know, we spent quite a bit of time and you've been really good and patient at, you know, explaining, you know, to me and many other people, you know, really what it's about and what it can do. And so one of the key things for me in terms of sort of legality, I was always very worried about the sort of anti-money laundering and are we just enabling people, you know, to launder money. And you explain that actually on the blockchain, it's totally transparent. You can know exactly where your money has come from and where it's, and actually more transparent than normal banking. So, you know, for me, that was a big tick in me moving forward. And I think it would be for many other people, really understanding that. I think, you know, if you talk to people, there's a concept of Ponzi scheme. And I think, you know, obviously with, you know, how cryptocurrencies and, you know, the pricing has been going recently, there's been a lot of media coverage of that. And of course, like in all things, there are Ponzi schemes. There are Ponzi schemes in real world finance, day in, day out, many. So, you know, I think it's not to be naive. You know, there will always be bad actors. There will always be bad structures. It's a very new sector. Business models are trying. I think there are a lot of people in tech who have got a lot to offer, super smart, but don't understand finance and don't understand regulation. And that's why we need to bridge. So two things, they need to move and kind of hold the hand to the regulators and explain in the way that you have, you know, been doing a sterling job and some of your other colleagues. And also the regulators need to, and they have been too, learning, understanding, talking about how they would see things. And when you really look at it, you know, the big answer is that nothing changes. You know, absolutely, you know, it's just another process. Financial markets are not going to change. You know, they have grown up in the way that they have grown because they work. Now, they could be more efficient. They could be cheaper. You know, there are things that can be improved through the use of blockchain. And I know that's something that's very close to your heart, the democratization of finance. We can talk a bit about that. And that's what excites me. That's why I'm in this sector.
This has been a real pleasure, Rosin, and I just want to say thank you very much for your contribution. I'm looking forward to listening to this again.
Thank you, Sean.
Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to The Gauge, Green Gauge's monthly podcast series. Subscribe to the podcast to stay informed of all our upcoming shows and keep up to date with the latest blockchain and digital asset analysis and thinking.